May it please the court, I am Peter Wacheski, number 28165 of the Defiance Law Firm, Defiance being the historical name of Glenwood Springs. Good morning. This is an action to establish paternity that was brought by the appellant's mother in the interest of the now adult child as identified in the trial court's law. Through the mother's eyes, before the child turned 18, which was not an issue for mother, she simply walked into the social services office in her county and asked that she be able to establish paternity with the man that her child was occasionally hanging out with, and the man who claimed he was the father of her child and with whom she had had sexual relations at the appropriate time in order to conceive such child. Social services hung on to the application and hung on to the case for quite a while. She went back to social services and said, "What about my paternity action?" And somebody higher up in social services said, "You know, since you've made your application and we haven't filed it yet, somebody has said that now maybe we can't file it because the child turned 18 years old." So a little bit of frustration there with the bureaucracy, and appellant came to see me, and I reviewed the statute and made the determination, as you can see in my argument, that she is still able to establish paternity as stated in the statute.
Well, let me ask you if I can, Mr. Wacheski, why doesn't RTL resolve this case? I mean, RTL, as I understand it, it involved a different presumption than the one we're dealing with here. I get that.
Yes.
But it, you know, it said, whether it's dicta or not, that we would look at 19-4-108 as opposed to 107 and say you got to file before the 18th birthday. Why doesn't that apply? Why would you treat one presumption differently from another presumption?
In the statutory scheme, several things are different. The establishment of paternity, the establishment of non-paternity. The establishment of paternity or non-paternity in a marital type case, an establishment of paternity or non-paternity in cases in which there is not a marital type relation. What we have here is not a marital type relation. We don't have any allegations that the parties ever lived together, things of that nature. What we have is a brief encounter 19 plus years ago, and now a motion to establish paternity. Moreover, the argument was never made in RTL that the statutes conflicted and one was later than the other. That was just never brought up. Further, focusing the holding in RTL toward what it was applied for and not to the facts in this particular case.
Well, and I understand the point. I mean, certainly one can argue it's dicta in RTL, which really just involved whether you can raise something as a defense regardless of the statute. But let's assume, you know, we're of course bound by RTL, and let's assume it applies here. Why would we treat the presumption that's at issue here different than the presumption that was at issue in RTL?
Well, I think that the question comes from asking why don't we take a holding in RTL that isn't necessarily a holding, and why don't we apply that here?
No, I understand that. Let's assume we get through that hurdle.
Okay,
let's assume it's a holding for argument's sake. What is the policy basis for treating the presumptions differently?
It's simply treated differently under the statute. I think it would be an extrapolation under the statute to make that application in this particular case. We are bolstered additionally by the body of law that says that in paternity cases, the child is a necessary party. There are several cases that say that based on a statute, and the child is a necessary party in the case. And if the child is a necessary party in the case, and the statute is specific, and it says that the child can bring an action until he is 21 years old, then taken as a whole, the interpretation should be at least until the person is 21. If you take a look at that statute of limitations statute, it's not as well written as it probably could be, because the first sentence says mother, social services, and the child can bring the action until the child turns 18. So therefore, the statute of limitations should apply to the child. But then you go a few sentences down, and it says the child can bring the action until the child is 21. So the statute of limitations, I would argue, is not quite as clear as it could be, and probably isn't to be given the weight that it needs to be given, especially when compared with the statute that precedes it, especially when that statute is later enacted than the statute that is 1410-108. So 1904-107 is later enacted than this limitation, this alleged limitation of actions of 18 years of 1904-108.
Mr. Sessions, not to get you off track, but since you brought up indispensable party, I was going to ask about it. I'm confused how that helps you. If in fact there's an indispensable party problem, your claim would be dismissed. It would be, you failed to join, normally the respondent would file the motion to dismiss for failure to join an indispensable party, you lose the case. So how does that help you, Eddie? Well, it would result in the dismissal of your claim.
We had filed a motion to join the indispensable party, which motion was denied by the trial court. So we
are... If the court found the child was indispensable, you lose. The case would be dismissed.
Well, if the child joins in the action and the child decides that he also wants to pursue the child support that later comes from a paternity determination, then it is a joint action and one that is determined by both. That is what makes him an indispensable party. Were the court to decide that the case proceeds because the statute of limitations hasn't been reached yet, and the child was not joined as an indispensable party, the arguments as shown in the reply brief would then come into effect, which is that the action could occur as to the father, once he's determined that he's the father, let's assume that, without the child, and then the child, if the child were to get his benefit before he were 21 years old, would have to bring an independent action, and it would be a mess, and if the support was already determined and support was already ordered, then where does the child have his independent right? His independent right gets foreclosed. So
why would that be? I'm sorry. I didn't understand that point.
Well, because let's say that mother's action continues, paternity is determined, child support is determined, and let's say there's a settlement, and father pays a lump sum of $100 to mother in satisfaction of all child support. Then child decides that he wants to bring another different independent action. It violates the father's rights because he's already had that issue determined and it's already been finalized.
On an issue preclusion basis? I'm not sure what...
Well, I guess it would be on a res judicata.
But the child wasn't a party to that proceeding.
I agree.
The child wouldn't be barred under either claim or issue preclusion.
And that's exactly why Rule 19 and the rule of joinder exists, because he needs to be brought into this case so that his rights can be determined so that it doesn't happen twice in a row. So the father is not subject to the same litigation by two different parties, and one is already settled, and then he's subject to another one. The ruling is going to be either he's already been adjudged and paid out, or he has to do it again.
But the child wouldn't be entitled to receive it twice. I mean, if the court ordered it in mom's case, and then the child brings a claim separately,
right.
The child may win, but the child can't recover. The court would certainly consider the fact that the child received child support for the last X whatever many years.
Why? Except that the child hasn't received any child support for the X number of years because no paternity has been established.
No, your hypothetical was mom wins. So okay. Mom brought it, court finds paternity, mom gets the award of child support.
Yes.
Your concern is that if child then brings a second claim, dad gets kind of hammered twice.
Correct.
And how would that be? The child can't recover the same child support a second time, to the extent it's a child's right. The court would say, you received what you're entitled to. Yes, I mean, but it's not an issue or a claim preclusion issue, seems to me. And correct me if I'm wrong. It may well be an issue if the kid can't get the damages twice. And
exactly.
So the court wouldn't award it a second time.
Exactly.
So where's the problem?
I guess his rights therefore need to be determined the first time, jointly. Because therefore it's possible that he could be precluded from something if he were to bring his own action.
And that's my question, why? If mom wins, he doesn't care. He's gotten the support he's entitled to. If mom loses, he gets the second bite at the apple.
He can
bring his claim. So where's the problem?
Well, I think the problem
is... And that's
is,
what the court, I think, found here, the trial court found.
I think the problem is in whether or not there is going to be some sort of a disturbance when there are two separate actions brought. Just the fact that two separate actions brought can be damaging enough. But the assumption that the child gets whatever support the child is entitled to because the mother received the money, that's a really iffy question. Because the mother is the one who is out the money during the time when the child is younger, and then as now when the child is older and out of the house, where does the division of the support go? It's a very tricky question. So that's why the child's rights has to be determined at the same time as the mother's rights. And unless there are more questions, I have about 4 minutes, 30 seconds left, which I would like to reserve for rebuttal if the court doesn't mind.
That would be fine, counsel. Thank you very much. Mr. Lee?
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Lee. I'm with the law firm of Bill Carr, Stonebreaker, and Hutchings. I'd like to make my comments addressed to the reasons why I believe the holding of an RTL is controlling, as Your Honor has indicated. The argument by mother is that there is an inconsistency between the provisions of 19-4-108 statute of limitations and 19-4-107-1A, which appears to have language that would indicate that mother could bring this paternity action at, quote, any time. I don't believe that there is an irreconcilable conflict between those two statutes. The court is, in addressing the issue as to whether or not these two statutes are irreconcilable, must follow CRS 2-4-206 and must attempt to harmonize the two statutes in question. And I think what it is clear from 19-4-108 that the General Assembly intended to specifically establish a statute of limitation time bar for the natural mother of a child to bring a paternity action, requiring that that action be brought before the child's 18th birthday.
Can I interrupt you here, Mr. Lee?
Yes.
I appreciate your focusing on this because this bugs me. So 19-4-107 in the title has the caption, when action may be brought. And in fact, RTL, as I recall, referred to 107 as a statute of limitations. I didn't use those words. Then you've got 108, that's called the statute of limitations. It does cause me some concern. I have to agree with Mr. Rochesky. This is not well drafting of these two statutes.
I agree.
Highly confusing. I mean, that's not either your fault, of course, but so maybe you can help me out on you, and I picked up on it. You say the legislature clearly intended because 108 calls statute of limitations, whatever else. I mean, you could make the same argument on 107, which is, you know, titled when action should be brought.
Well, I think it's clear that 108 is a specific provision that is intended as a statute of limitation or time bar. I don't believe that 19-4-107-1A is a specific provision. It's more of a general provision. My belief, and I agree.
Why is one thing more specific than the other?
Because 19-4-108 is specifically entitled the statute of limitations, and everyone understands the principles of the statute of limitations as being a time bar to preclude the bringing of an action after a certain period of time. So I believe that's why it's specific.
Can I let me float a different hypothetical to you or hypothesis, and please push back. One could arguably read 107 as the more specific, because 107 deals with when you have presumptions at play. And 108 is more general, doesn't talk about when the presumptions are at play. You could read it that way, too.
I agree. I think what the legislature was intending by 107 primarily was to establish the time bar as applied to a putative father bringing a action to establish non-paternity. So specifically what the statute is saying is that the father who wishes to bring an action to determine the non-existence of the father and child relationship must bring that action within 5 years after the child's birth or sooner if that is practical.
But how does that argument square with 1A? Or, you know, 1A talks about bringing action at any time for the purpose of declaring the existence of the relationship. 1B talks about declaring the non-existence of a relationship. It does seem to cover both there.
And my response is, if you look at the definition of child, that is set forth, excuse me, in 19(1)-103(18), child is defined as a person less than 18 years of age. So I believe that what the legislature was assuming was because they're talking about the ability of the natural mother or others to bring an action to declare the existence of the father and child relation. By implication, the legislature was assuming this would have to be done before the child turned 18 years of age, because that's the definition of child. Once an individual is over the age of 18, they're no longer considered a child, and therefore the action could not be brought at that time. And so then the legislature, that's my explanation for why they have that provision there in 107.1a. And it's clear by the holding in RTL that the Colorado Supreme Court agreed that the legislature in 108 was specifically enacting a provision to establish that time bar. So under the case law authority that deals with how courts are to construe inconsistencies in statutes, if there is a provision that is more specific, that is to be controlled. So it is my position that specific provision of 108 operates as a time bar, so that statute limitation, and precluded mother from bringing that action once the child turned 18 years of age. In terms of the indispensable party argument, I believe that appellate counsel has misstated the law in Colorado concerning whether or not a child is an indispensable party in a paternity action. Under the Uniform Parentage Act prior to 1986, before it was repealed and reenacted, the child was an indispensable party. But in 1986, the General Assembly reenacted the UPA and specifically made the determination as to whether or not a child was an indispensable party to be discretionary within the court. It's not required to be done. Therefore, I think the court, you know, the trial court in this case, correctly followed the procedures and looked at Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 9 to determine whether or not, under the Rule of Civil Procedure, the party was an indispensable party, the child, excuse me, was an indispensable party. I believe the court correctly determined that the child was not. I also believe that appellant's sole argument to the court on appeal is not whether or not the child actually was indispensable or not, but appellant was maintaining that the court simply did not make sufficient findings of fact of record to justify the court's determination that, in fact, the child was not an indispensable party. And I believe that Your Honor has correctly noted that, in fact, the court did make those findings of fact. The court found that the child had an independent right to bring the action until the child turned 21 years of age. Therefore, the child's interests or rights would not be affected in any way by the court's dismissal of mother's action. And the court also determined clearly that by dismissing mother's action and applying the statute of limitations of 19(4)-108, the court was in fact affording complete relief to father and to mother, stating, you're not entitled to bring the action, mother and father, in terms of this particular action, the relief you're afforded is I'm going to dismiss the action. Unless you have any other questions, specific questions for me, that's all the comments I have.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Mr. Ocheski, you have 4 minutes and 24 seconds.
Thank you.
As stated in my reply brief, we addressed the case of RTL. And the case of RTL, which it has been alluded to, that seems to state that there could be an 18-year-old time bar, which may be more broadly applied, possibly toward this case, the answer lies within 3 itself, as stated in the answer brief. It was stated quite clearly at the very end of page 511 that in this particular case on RTL, attacks on the presumptions based on marriage or a relationship that is like marriage are therefore restricted to a limited circle of potential contestants, but presumptions created in other circumstances may be attacked more freely. And that quotes the uniform laws annotated on the Uniform Parentage Act, the commissioner's comment. That holding in and of itself recognizes that when you have a non-parental relationship, there may need to be allowed more time to establish paternity. And I would argue that the limitation of action section in 19-4108 does not limit, as I've stated before, the determination of paternity in this particular case. Regarding child support, there is a separate statute altogether that limits the time in which you can bring an action for child support, which is separate than the action that we have here today, to the child being 21 years of age. So if you file a motion after the child turns 21 asking for child support, the statute of limitations is much more clear in that particular case. Although paternity precedes child support, we are here today simply on the matter of child support. Also, opposed counsel is correct that the statute was corrected to include the word may as to whether or not a child is an indispensable party. But the question becomes whether or not may was included so as to remove impediments of having to get guardians ad litem in every single case in which the child is a minor, in establishing child support and paternity and other things, rather than whether or not it was simply absolutely discretionary with the court as to whether the child could be an indispensable party. The reasons behind the original statute, which mandated that the child was an indispensable party, and the reasoning from the cases that flow from it, which are cited in the briefs, still hold true. The child is an indispensable party, is mother's position, but as opposing counsel has pointed out, the trial court down below did not address any factors in determining whether or not the child was an indispensable party, merely made a holding and the finding that the child had an independent right to go forward with child support, which we contend actually supports making the child an indispensable party. Basically, the court below ruled that mother is precluded under the statute of limitations, and therefore there is no reason to join the child. So it was kind of a cart behind the horse, and that was the reason the ruling was made. If the court makes a ruling that mother can continue, then the indispensable party decision is another one that needs to be considered. If the court considers that 18 years is the bar, then probably the indispensable party issue becomes moot. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cheskin, and thank you as well, Mr. Lee, for your arguments and the briefs in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.